From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We want to get right to this morning's commuter train crash in Hoboken, New Jersey. A New Jersey transit train crashed into the Hoboken station around 8:45 this morning in the middle of rush hour. At least 100 are injured. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie tells MSNBC at least one person has died. TV footage and photos show a terrifying scene, a collapsed roof, a train car inside the station. Here's an eyewitness speaking with the BBC.
I saw water was coming down from the ceiling. There were people climbing out of the windows of the front car. Many appeared to be injured. Some had blood coming from their, you know, their faces or their limbs. There appeared to be some who were unconscious. It was unfortunately a pretty difficult scene to take in.
Well, of course, the Hoboken terminal has been evacuated. Dr. Ken Garay, the chief medical officer for Jersey City Medical Center, spoke to reporters this morning.
There are three serious patients with orthopedic injuries, some internal injuries, and some deep lacerations. They are being treated by our trauma surgeons as we speak. In addition, there are a handful of other patients who are currently being evaluated for their injuries in the emergency room.
NPR's Jasmine Gard is there. I believe, Jasmine, you're right across the street from the station. What's happening there?
It's a pretty grim mood right now. The entire section of the train station is completely cut off. Multiple fire trucks, ambulances, police trying to assist with the rescue. And a news conference is pending shortly.
Yeah, well, we're looking at photographs of an aerial scene. It's just amazing. You see the train backed up on the tracks, off the tracks, actually, a part of it. And I'm imagining this is a commuter train, so maybe relatives are relatively nearby. Do we know anything about the train, where it was coming from?
Sure. This is a train that was headed into the Hoboken terminal. It's a commuter train, like you said. So it connects people from New Jersey to the World Trade Center area, to Midtown. And this also happened right in the middle of rush hour at around 8:30. So it would have been completely packed, which is why they are reporting over 100 injuries.
Yeah. And do we know if the injuries were on people from the train or from the platform?
We have no confirmations right now. What we do know is that in addition to the injuries of people on the train, there was a great deal of concern over the structural integrity of the station. It's a very old, very beautiful station, but very old. So yeah, there were concerns about that.
Look, we want to be very sensitive here. You just mentioned the World Trade area, which is, you know, people commute from New Jersey. Of course, New Jersey also saw, you know, an attack recently. Do we have any sense of what might have caused this accident?
We have absolutely no confirmation. There's been no mention of any type of causes. There is going to be a press conference shortly in which I'm sure they will address this.
Yeah. New Jersey Transit says it averages 15,000 passengers there a week. This has to be, I mean, the most important thing, of course, are the lives impacted directly by this crash today, but what is this doing to commuting on this major corridor?
Absolutely. So it's pretty much at a standstill. There is no Jersey Transit happening right now, but New York Waterway ferries are accepting New Jersey Transit tickets. New Jersey Transit buses are also honoring tickets, and Uber announced they will be refunding all rides from the Hoboken station until noon on Thursday. But we did talk to people who are just going to be working from home or staying home because the trains are at a standstill.
Well, and we have to remind people, of course, who are other parts of the country, this is part of a corridor that goes from Maine all the way down, you know, to Florida practically, and definitely the Boston, New York, Washington part is hugely traveled, so it's just going to be, expect delays today. NPR reporter Jasmine Gard on the scene of this morning's train crash in Hoboken, New Jersey, a train right into the station. Jasmine, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In the presidential race, Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson is making headlines today, and not in the way he'd like. Johnson drew a major blank on MSNBC last night. In a town hall hosted by Chris Matthews, it was his second big foreign policy gaffe in less than a month.
Who's your favorite foreign leader?
Who's my favorite?
Just name anywhere in the country, any one of the continents, any country. Name one foreign leader that you respect and look up to. Anybody.
Mine was Shimon Peres.
No, okay, I'm talking about living. Go ahead. You got to do this anywhere, any continent. Canada, Mexico, Europe over there, Asia, South America, Africa. Name a foreign leader that you respect.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment in the former president of Mexico.
But I'm giving you the whole world.
I know.
Anybody in the world you like. Anybody. Pick any leader.
The former president of Mexico.
And he couldn't name that president that he was talking about. Johnson's inability to name one foreign leader he admires comes just a few weeks after he asked, what is Aleppo, when he was asked what he'd do about the besieged Syrian city. Yet despite these lapses in knowledge of foreign policy, Johnson is polling in double digits in some key states. Daniel Strauss is a reporter with Politico. He joins us now from Washington. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Do these gaffes seem to be hurting Johnson at all?
Not really, but they don't seem to be helping him either. It just puts him in sort of a standstill or neutral if he were some kind of car. On the one hand, he's getting a lot of momentum in terms of both endorsements from newspapers around the country. He just got the endorsement of the Detroit News. But on the other hand, he's falling into a trap that libertarian candidates often face, which is the feeling that from voters that they are weak on foreign policy, not being able to name a foreign leader that he admires, not being able to identify Aleppo in Syria. These are issues that won't help him at a time that he really needs help.
And he wasn't on the debate stage, and he won't be on the debate stage with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump for any of the debates because he wasn't polling high enough. But if you look in some of the key swing states, he's up in the double digits.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There, he's still competitive, and he's still proving to be a thorn in Hillary Clinton's paw, if you will. Places like Maine, Colorado, he's a serious threat, and he's drawing voters that would otherwise probably vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump in this election to his side.
There are two other third-party candidates this year, Green Party nominee Jill Stein and independent Evan McMullen. How are they polling?
So McMullen is polling abysmally. He's polling somewhere between 1% nationally and zero. And then in two states, he's polling. In Utah, he's polling at around 9%. And then in Virginia, about 3%. Stein averages in the single digits, low single digits nationally, and about the same in key battleground states.
And at the Green Party convention in August, a reporter from nonprofit video news site The Real News asked Jill Stein if she was hoping she'd be able to take Republican votes as well as Democratic votes. And here's what she said.
In fact, I feel like we're offering, we're not taking. And in fact, you know, the American people have rejected these campaigns. Mm-hmm. Even the majority of Hillary's supporters actually don't support Hillary. They just don't like their other choice of Donald. Mm-hmm. And the majority of Donald's supporters actually don't really support him. They just don't like their other choice of Hillary. Yeah. So people are begging for other options. And what we're doing is giving the American people choices. We're supposed to have choices in this democracy. We're not supposed to have to just vote against what we fear.
Is she right there? Are most people backing third-party candidates, supporting them because they really know and believe in what those candidates stand for? Or are people doing it essentially as a protest vote?
So polling shows mostly that for Stein, a lot of her supporters are natural Green Party candidates, as in they would be voting for Stein even if this election wasn't between Donald Trump as a Republican presidential nominee and Hillary Clinton. But the draw for Gary Johnson this time around is that there are two primary or mainstream party candidates with high unfavorables, and that's attracting a wave of supporters to his side.
What would the two things that if I were to ask a voter about Jill Stein, what is it that you like about her? What are the things that she stands for that people are drawn to?
They would say that she's a liberal alternative to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and that she I think they would say something like she tells it like it is on key issues like climate change.
Hmm. And what about Evan McMullen? Where's he drawing support from, and what does he stand for?
So McMullen is a bit of a cipher here. He's very new to the race. He jumped in August as a conservative alternative to Trump, and his basic draw is that he is a dignified, decent actual conservative compared to Trump. That's what he claims. That's how he's trying to attract supporters. So a lot of his support, what little there is, comes from voters who are dissatisfied with the Republican presidential ticket.
And people are especially looking at him to potentially have an impact in Utah, correct?
Yeah, well, that's his plan. He wants to, his real plan, and he said this, and we've reported on this both in terms of public statements and fundraising pitches he's sent to donors, is that if he can win Utah, hopefully he can split the Electoral College and send the race to the House of Representatives, where hopefully the Republican House of Representatives would be so impressed by his campaign that they would elect him president of the United States. It is a very, very long shot plan.
And Daniel, just briefly, do you expect that the major party candidates, and perhaps especially Hillary Clinton, is going to be going after some of the supporters of these third party candidates as we get into the final month of the campaign?
Absolutely. You can see allies of Hillary Clinton already in the last few days saying things, making arguments against voting for a third party candidate. Both President Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, and even other big name candidates or figures like George Takei have made arguments for this.
That's Daniel Strauss, politics reporter at Politico. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
The new documentary Among the Believers opens in New York tomorrow. The film goes deep inside the world of religious extremism in Pakistan. It centers around Mullah Abdul Aziz, an avowed supporter of ISIS and the Taliban. He's the head of the Red Mosque Network, which seeks to bring Pakistan under Sharia law. The network operates a series of madrasas, religious schools where students are trained to take part in holy war or jihad. Lessons start early. Here's how a madrasa textbook teaches Urdu, the national language of Pakistan.
Instead of A for apple or something similar to that, it's A for Allah. Instead of B for boy or B for something else, B for banduk. It's a gun.
That's a scene from Among the Believers. And joining us to talk about the film are the co-directors, Hemal Trivedi and Mohammed Naqvi. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And one of the first things I want to ask you is, how did you get the access that you needed to tell this story and to make this film?
Well, what I will say is that it was a very, very long process. I mean, the production, it was like the waiting game, if you will, in some sense, where I had to meet Maulana Abdulaziz, who's the main subject of our film. The way I kind of gained his trust was I had to meet him at a level playing field. And for me, that was asking him questions about my own spirituality and my own faith, Islam. Once we were able to form a connection there, I was able to cover a lot more ground with him.
Well, what do you mean by you had to ask questions about your own faith?
As a young Muslim Pakistani who moved to New York in August of 2001, I didn't really think of myself as someone who was really identified with my faith. I kind of just left it compartmentalized and looked at it more as a cultural thing. But it became a much more marked part of my identity after 9/11. But it was also the first time that I considered myself not part of, you know, the collective American population. I saw myself as the other. And it was that kind of led me into investigating my own identity. And the way I kind of did that was through my films. And so this most latest film was definitely an exploration into that and to actually ask questions about my faith and spirituality.
And in the moment that you are talking to Aziz in the film, are you or is somebody actually in the room with him? I couldn't tell whether you were actually in the room with him or whether he was answering a phone or something like that.
Well, we shot with him on many different occasions. Usually it would be me, my co-producer, Sayed Musharraf Shah, sometimes a DP. And then, of course, there was always his own security.
With their big guns, by the way.
With their big, scary guns and everything. That was definitely something that was really etched in my mind the first time we went to his house in this middle-class neighborhood in Islamabad and were greeted by these scary men with Kalashnikovs, and they search me and my entire team. And we enter this house, and in the courtyard are 10, 15 more guards with guns. One of them escorts us into this house, and it's like a dramatic setup where you enter, and in this living room is Maulana Abdulaziz sitting on the floor with this really kind, reassuring expression on his face. It's almost a little maniacal, if you will, I mean, given the circumstances.
Well, Hemal, let me bring you in here because one of the things that we also see in this film, in addition to Aziz, is we meet some children, one who has run away from the madrasa, a girl named Zarina, and then Tala, a young man from a moderate Muslim family who studies at the madrasa and decides to become a jihadist preacher. Why do the kids go?
You know, that brings back to the initial quest that I wanted to answer when I started making this film. The inception of this film was I lost a very dear friend in Mumbai terror attacks. And following these attacks, I really wanted to understand why does this phenomenon exist and what's happening. And what I realized was that Pakistan is a deeply divided country. There is a fringe minority of extremists who are trying to take over the way of life of vast majority of Pakistanis. And this fringe minority are actually filling the vacuum that the government has left unfilled. It's the government's job to provide children or citizens of its country with food and shelter and clothing and education. But that vacuum is filled by these madrasas, which to a lot of families is actually a free daycare. You know, a lot of people have multiple kids and they do not have means to feed their kids. So they send them to these madrasas, not knowing what these madrasas are all about.
How can they not know, though? I think that's a question that came up. Is the point you're making is that it's an issue of poverty. People just simply have to send their kids to these places where they can be fed and clothed and all of that. But how can they not know the kinds of things that are being taught in the madrasas?
It's because, you know, traditionally, like, madrasa was never a political institution. It was more an institution where you study about religion and about ways to reconnect with God. And so for the parents, they're like, we are sending our kid to a place where hopefully he will learn about the faith and the religion and the ways to reach heaven. It's just that these madrasas have become this political tool and have become these weapons in the hands of people who see these kids as cannon fodder, as against, you know, students who want to educate themselves.
We're speaking with Hemal Trivedi and Mohammed Naqvi about their new film, Among the Believers. And Mohammed, you were actually brought up in this tradition, weren't you?
Yes. I come from a Muslim family. I am a Muslim. But it would be unfair to say that all madrasas across Pakistan are training militants or espousing hateful ideology. That would be inaccurate to say that. Many of them are simply there, similar to how you have Sunday school here or Friday school for some religions, right? You study the holy texts, you have some arts and crafts, and then they send you on their merry way. That was kind of similar to the madrasa that I went to. Then there are other madrasas where they're more involved in the sense that you get to live there. And their curriculum can also be varied in the sense that there was one madrasa that we saw even in the production of this film where you had other courses where they did teach you languages. You had history, you had social studies, you had geography, you had mathematics, you had even computers, except it was through the prism of some Islamic perspective.
Well, and do you think that the madrasas are connected to the terrorism that we see around the world now, that those people who are committing those acts likely came from these kinds of schools or that they radicalized later?
If you're asking me, are some of the militants and the terrorist attacks that are carried out in Pakistan in our recent contemporary history, are they linked to the Red Mosque? Yes, some of them are. And it's not just the Red Mosque. Of course, there are other madrasa networks throughout Pakistan. But worldwide, no, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, worldwide, a lot of it is online social media network recruiting. A lot of it is second, third generation immigrants, really. Disaffected youth on their quest for looking for adventure or are somehow manifesting their own adolescent angst or rage into this very destructive form of militancy.
Now, Hemal, this film has been banned in Pakistan, right?
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Well, the Pakistani government banned this film primarily because it saw this film as a threat to their pursuit to combat terrorism within Pakistan.
So it was the government that banned it?
The government saw this as a threat to their pursuit to combat extremism again in Pakistan, which is kind of ironical because, you know, they haven't banned institutions that do that, and they've banned our film. Mohammed can talk about the recent case in which Aziz was acquitted from the charges against him for inciting violence and for hate speech.
Basically, what the state decided, the courts in Pakistan decided, was to dismiss the case and to not listen to the appeal because they felt it was just an attention-getting ploy from Maulana Aziz, and they're not taking it seriously, which is amazing considering the history of this man and militant activities that he has been actually charged with and, you know, participated in the past. It's amazing.
You showed this film to Aziz. What was his reaction?
So actually, that was something that we'd been discussing for months, and it was a really scary experience because we had supporters of the Red Mosque and Taliban supporters calling us and saying that this film better represent Maulana Aziz accurately or we'd have to suffer the consequences. And we had to kind of put everything in the back burner until we actually met Maulana Aziz to show him the whole film in its entirety and alleviate any concerns.
And how did he react?
He liked it. In fact, he endorsed it fully, and he said that this is a very accurate representation of my point of view and different factions and fissures in the Pakistan society and within the field of education.
He also said that the film should be shown worldwide and everybody should watch the film. So I hope that that message is spread.
Well, Hemal Trivedi and Mohammed Naqvi, they are the co-directors of the film Among the Believers. It opens in New York tomorrow and will be available via streaming services at the end of October. It's a fascinating look at the Red Mosque in Pakistan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
There was a private funeral mass this morning for Jose Fernandez, the 24-year-old star pitcher for the Miami Marlins, who was killed in that boating accident off Miami Beach early Sunday. Yesterday, thousands of his fans filed by his closed casket in a Miami church. Rick Gireno was among them.
Sad, man. Just sad, devastated, crushed. I mean, every word you possibly could describe on losing someone like that.
And someone like that doesn't refer to his pitching skills. Fernandez made several attempts to defect from Cuba. One of them, he saved his mom from drowning. He finally made it to the U.S., became a citizen in 2014. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. We want to talk baseball with Mike today, but Mike, we have to start with Fernandez. I mean, his teammates wearing his name and number the first game back, second baseman D. Gordon hitting a home run the first at-bat. You know, your thoughts on the emotion we've been seeing.
D. Gordon hit his first home run of the season. He's not a home run hitter. And as he was rounding the bases, he burst into tears. And Travis d'Arnaud, the catcher on the Mets, met him and he was in tears. I watched that whole series. I'm a Mets fan. And afterwards, the Marlins hugged the Mets and really appreciated the generosity of spirit. Jose Fernandez, Ben Lindbergh of The Ringer, likened him to Buddy Holly in terms of the death at such a young age. I would think about maybe Heath Ledger. It can't be overstated the potential of Fernandez as a player. I looked over every player who died while playing and made the Hall of Fame, and including some other good ones like Thurman Munson, Hall of Fame players like Addie Joss and Roberto Clemente. I could say with certainty that Fernandez, as a player who died too young to make the Hall of Fame, had the best career beyond him. His next year was going to be better than any other player who died while playing. And also a tremendous love of the game that transcended the game. And the last big part of it is the most popular and important Cuban player in Miami sports history.
Yeah, well, so this is, you know, casting a big, long shadow. But the season continues. So just in the seconds we have, we're heading into the final weekend of the regular season. Plenty of wild card playoff drama left. Those races not decided, but we know division winners. Start with the American League. The Boston Red Sox clinched the East. Cleveland Indians won Central. Texas Rangers won West. Who do you like?
Texas has a great lineup. Cleveland's pitching is hurt, but the odds makers tell me that Boston's the best team. The advanced metrics even say Boston's as good as the Cubs are, and the Cubs have won over 100 games. I would say the back end of Boston's bullpen, the closer, for instance, Craig Kimbrell, gave up a grand slam to lose the game to the Yankees. But that's a problem. But yes, let us say that the Red Sox are the best in the AL, which leads us to the NL, right?
Well, you mentioned the Cubs. Nationals clinch the East, the Cubs the Central, Dodgers the West, but everybody's talking about the Cubs.
And what a matchup that would be. Theo Epstein, the GM or whatever, you know, his title, like
guru.
President of the team, the guru who assembled both those teams. And if Theo Epstein gets the Cubs a victory and will have done that for the Cubs and the Red Sox, he is on the Mount Rushmore of GMs or front office personnel in baseball history. His competition will come mainly from the Dodgers, possibly whoever wins the wild card.
Yeah.
I would discount the Nationals because they have injuries as of late, and we don't know if Strasburg will pitch.
Fighting words for them, but we just have to say Vin Scully will be calling his final game on Sunday for the Dodgers. Attention will be paid. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist, Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Obama leaves the White House today for Israel. Tomorrow he will attend the funeral of former Israeli President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres. Last night at Fort Lee in Virginia, President Obama participated in a town hall on military issues on CNN. The forum followed the Pentagon announcement that 600 more U.S. troops will be deployed to Iraq to support the upcoming offensive to retake Mosul from ISIS. Tina Houchins, whose 19-year-old son Aaron was killed in Baghdad in 2007, asked the president why he won't use the term Islamic terrorist.
If you had an organization that was going around killing and blowing people up and said, we're on the vanguard of Christianity, well, as a Christian, I'm not going to let them claim my religion and say you're killing for Christ. I would say that's ridiculous. That's not what my religion stands for. Call these folks what they are, which is killers and terrorists. And that's what we've been trying to do, is to make sure that, A, we don't validate their claims that somehow they speak for Islam, because they don't, and B, making sure that we do not make Muslims, who are well-meaning and are natural allies on this fight, because these groups are killing more Muslims than they're killing anybody else, make sure that they don't feel as if somehow this is some contest between the West and Islam.
The president was also asked about athletes refusing to stand for the national anthem.
I want everybody to listen to each other. So I want Mr. Kaepernick and others who are on a knee, I want them to listen to the pain that that may cause somebody who, for example, had a spouse or a child who was killed in combat, and why it hurts them to see somebody not standing. But I also want people to think about the pain that he may be expressing about somebody who's lost a loved one that they think was unfairly shot.
President Obama there at last night's military town hall, that audio courtesy of CNN. Tomorrow, an herbal supplement called Kratom could be made illegal by the Drug Enforcement Agency. Kratom users say it helps them manage pain without opioids, or even helps them kick an opioid addiction, and the DEA's plans have angered users. One petition on WhiteHouse.gov protesting the decision has gathered more than 138,000 signatures in less than a month. Rebecca Smith of Side Effects Public Media has the story.
Jenny Slain is the manager of Retroactive, a smoke shop in Columbia, Missouri. She sells incense, hookahs, and e-cigs. She also sells an herbal supplement called Kratom that she keeps behind the counter.
So we have like the K-Chill brand and then the pure Kratom. And then the K-Chill comes in three different kinds.
Kratom is a plant native to Southeast Asia. Consumers of Kratom here in the U.S. ingest it as a capsule or brew it as a tea. And many say it helps them manage pain and opioid withdrawal. This smoke shop has carried Kratom products for close to a decade, and the store's buyer, Andrew Grafman, says Kratom has gotten more popular over time.
Once someone comes in and buys it once, they're usually back again and back the next week and the next week.
The store's regulars include people like construction workers, who deal with chronic pain and come in every few days for Kratom. But this popular herb could be unavailable legally as early as tomorrow. The DEA intends to classify kratom as a Schedule I drug, putting it in the same category as heroin and LSD. The main chemical compounds in kratom act like opioids in the brain, but Grafman says some kratom users tell him the herbal supplement isn't as addictive as prescription pills, and it manages pain just as effectively.
The kratom doesn't have any addictive properties in it, so it really helped in that sense that they can still get that same feeling without the addiction part.
The DEA disagrees, calling kratom an imminent hazard to public safety. Russ Baer is a DEA spokesperson, and he says anecdotal evidence from kratom users isn't enough to prove the drug's medicinal value.
We're not saying that kratom is as dangerous as heroin, as fentanyl. We're simply saying that kratom, at this point, until the FDA determines otherwise, fulfills the statutory criteria of a Schedule I controlled substance.
Meaning kratom has a high potential for abuse and no approved medical use. The DEA cited 15 kratom-related deaths worldwide between 2014 and 2016. Baer says the DEA believes kratom needs to go through the same strict FDA approval process as other medicines intended for human consumption. But the problem is, there haven't been many studies about kratom and its uses.
We don't know enough about kratom as of yet to label it the same way as heroin.
Oliver Grundman is a toxicologist at the University of Florida and has done research on kratom. He published an article last year about what is known about kratom, its traditional uses and anecdotal benefits, but
the research community wants to know more about potential medical benefits and how these drugs actually influence the human body.
Grundman says he understands the DEA's concerns about another unregulated drug, especially during the current opioid epidemic. But still, he worries that by making kratom a Schedule I drug, the DEA will make it completely unavailable to researchers for further study. With that in mind, a group of 51 bipartisan U.S. representatives sent a letter to the DEA this week urging them to delay their final decision regarding kratom. Other critics of the move include the Drug Policy Alliance, which advocates for smart drug policy. Jag Davies is the director of communication strategy. And he says the DEA's, quote, knee-jerk reaction to kratom could set up this potentially useful drug for the same struggles as cannabis.
Kratom suffers the same fate that every other medicinal plant face, which is that there's no financial incentive for pharmaceutical companies to put a plant that anyone can grow through clinical trials.
Back in Columbia, Missouri, the retroactive smoke shops are warning regular customers about the upcoming change and getting ready to hand over their kratom stock to local law enforcement when the new classification goes into effect. For Here and Now, I'm Rebecca Smith.
In South Africa, the search is on for a missing zoo penguin. Last week, Buddy, an endangered male African black-footed penguin, was taken by two men, both students, who have since come forward through an attorney saying that they meant no harm. They broke in, snatched Buddy from Bay World, that's a marine park in Port Elizabeth, popped him into the trunk of a car, and then drove him to a nearby beach and left him. Joining us now is Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first, just tell us a little bit about this penguin.
This story's so sad. The break-in was a week ago, Wednesday. The staff realized that Buddy was missing the next morning, and security footage revealed what had happened. So Buddy has a microchip in his flipper, but it's for identification, not tracking. And at this point, there's still no sign of him. So here's this small, flightless bird who was born in captivity and has never had to fend for himself. But you know what? There's some hope. Buddy's a little pudgy, and he can live off fat stores for maybe two more weeks. But these little penguins weigh 5 to 7 pounds to begin with, so it's hard to imagine him doing well. His wild cousins dive for fish and squid in the open sea, which he's never done.
And the people that took him said that they were doing so to make a point about captivity, but they may have killed an endangered animal in, by doing so.
Right. I'm skeptical of the motivation, allegedly being peddled by the lawyer, by the way. But this looks more like a drunken prank than a protest. But no matter what, these guys may have killed an endangered animal, as you say. Releasing animals into the wild is so complicated, even when the experts try. So one survey that counted up serious reintroduction efforts over something like a 90-year period found out that 145 out of 145, only 16 had been successful. And the factors are nearly endless. I mean, how will this animal feed himself? Do predators know how to hunt? Do prey animals know how to hide? Is there suitable habitat? Is this a social species? If so, will that individual be accepted? Will he catch a disease, spread a disease? What's instinctive? instinctive for an animal. I mean, captive cheetah from the United States was brought to Namibia in 1977, for example, to see if hunting skills are hardwired in that species. That cat indicated that they're not. And great apes learn throughout their lifetimes, and we've seen terrible loss of life when people have released adult captive chimps or gorillas into the wild. And one case involved a famous chimp who went from fixing gin and tonics in the U.S. to being killed, probably by poachers in Africa.
But it does bring up this question about keeping animals in zoos or aquariums, which a lot of people have a problem with.
There's definitely a growing discussion of how we treat animals. It's animal welfare groups, people in general differ. It's a polarizing topic. But according to the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, more Americans go to zoos every year than to all professional football, baseball, hockey, and basketball games combined.
Wow. That's amazing.
It is 181 people a year.
181 million people a year.
And whether or not people go to the zoo for this aspect, many zoos do some tremendous work for conservation. But I hope this story, everyone agrees, means we can't just dump animals into the wild.
Don't just go take animals out of the zoo and put them out on their own. There's the lesson. Vicky Croak, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Now to one of the most competitive House races in the country. It's Arizona's 1st Congressional District, and it's something of a musical chair, so follow along. Former State Senator Tom O'Halloran is the Democrat, although he was once a Republican. He's facing Republican Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babiou. They're competing to fill the House seat left vacant by the Democratic incumbent Ann Kirkpatrick, who's trying to take Republican John McCain's U.S. Senate seat away from him. But the House race between O'Halloran and Babiou has been characterized as one of the few places Republicans might turn a seat red without redistricting. But the Republican candidate in this House race is so controversial, as the Washington Post writes, even his sisters are warning people not to vote for him. Laurel Morales is senior field correspondent for the Fronteras Desk at Here and Now contributor KJZZ. She joins us for our weekly district profile. She's in Flagstaff. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, Robin.
We'll start with the Republican Paul Babiou. He's been in the national news. He was head of business operations at a Massachusetts school in the late 90s. The school was shut down after the state discovered widespread abuse. A local Arizona station found a tape of him praising some of the practices of the punishment of the kids. He also had a dropout of a 2012 congressional race after his Mexican immigrant ex-boyfriend threatened to out him. Babiou is an immigration hardliner. How are these backstories affecting his race? Does it make his backers like him even more? How's this working out for him?
Actually, after he dropped out of that race, he went on to be reelected as sheriff of Pinal County. So in this race, he ran against a strong candidate in the primary and won. And two polls show it as a toss-up, and one poll does show voters leaning Democrat. So it's possible that these scandals have affected him, although this rural district, the voters here seem to like his tough-on-immigration stance.
Well, in fact, let's listen to an interview he did in August on Fox Business, where he touts Donald Trump's plan to build a wall along the Mexican border.
And more important than the fence, most of us forget about this, it's the enforcement of the law. There's got to be consequences for breaking immigration law. And today, under President Obama, there is no law because there's no consequence.
Well, so, Laurel, there's immigration, but what are some of the other issues in the race?
So environment and water, since we're in Arizona, those are both really big issues here. Tom O'Halloran is for increasing solar and wind power through government regulations, while Babiou has said he wants to deregulate the EPA and fight to keep coal-fired power plants open for jobs and to keep energy costs low. O'Halloran has said he supports most mining for the jobs as long as it doesn't pollute groundwater.
I want to hear more about the Democrat, Tom O'Halloran, but you said something interesting that Babiou is against regulations that might hurt the coal industry. Is there a lot of that in Arizona?
Yes, and in this district is really diverse. There's copper miners and other miners in this district. There's it's 25% Native American. There's mining near and on reservation land that has become a controversial issue here. There are retirees. There's a college community that tends to vote Democrat in this district, and lots of veterans. So it's pretty diverse.
Right. Well, let's talk about the Democrat, Tom O'Halloran. As we said, he had been a Republican. Here's part of a recent video his campaign put out.
Middle-income Arizona is having a hard time sending their own children to our universities. That's not right. We talk a lot about what we can do for our economy to bring back jobs. The best thing we can do is make sure our citizenry is educated.
Laurel, tell us more about his switch Republican to Democrat and how the voters there receive him.
Yeah, when he was a state lawmaker representing Sedona, he switched parties from Republican to Independent, and then just before announcing his run for Congress, became a Democrat. Some have called this opportunistic or selling out, but O'Halloran sees it as a strength, and he says he knows how to work with everybody. And it's important to keep in mind that both Democrats and Republicans have held this seat, and a moderate candidate has been successful in the past. Ann Kirkpatrick was successfully elected to the office 3 times, and she's a moderate Democrat.
Well, real quick, you've got O'Halloran, the Democrat, and Babiou, the Republican. Has Babiou endorsed Trump? Has O'Halloran endorsed Clinton? And how would, you know, how is that going over in the state?
Yeah, so Sheriff Babiou has come out supporting Trump. O'Halloran supports Clinton. In Arizona, typically it's not a divided state. The last time it elected a Democrat was reelecting Bill Clinton in 96, and before that it was 1948 when Arizona helped elect Truman. For the first time in over 100 years, the Arizona Republic, the largest newspaper in the state, has endorsed a Democrat, and that is Hillary Clinton. So it's considered a divided state that may or may not affect this race. We're not sure.
Huh. Laurel Morales, senior field correspondent for the Fronteras Desk there in Arizona. Laurel, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we have all our district profiles and our Senate trackers at hearandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.